We're talking the magicians, great minds, and the central miracle of science. Jump aboard. Marcus Chown, our special guest. He's live in the United Kingdom, and we'll go to your calls when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Marcus Chown with us, of course. Marcus, when you were at Pasadena, the California Institute of Technology there, what was it like working on a radio telescope?
Well, it's a funny thing, really, because the radio telescopes are in the Owens Valley, which is a five-mile drive north of Pasadena, just, and it's in the high desert, about 4,000 feet. And really, I was only a student. I used to be there overnight while the telescopes remotely were making observations. I had to change the magnetic tapes. And so it didn't really give you any sense of astronomy. So this is one of the reasons why I became actually a science writer and a journalist, because I got into astronomy because I used to see all these fantastic pictures, you know, in books, in the library, of, you know, exploding galaxies and nebulae and all that sort of stuff. But what I didn't realize is that astronomers haven't really looked through telescopes for more than a century. You know, I mean, once they discovered, once they had photographic plates, the photography is hundreds of times more sensitive than the naked eye. So even with visible light, they didn't look through telescopes. And radio waves, well, of course, we can't see radio waves, you know. So I had no real sense that I was actually doing astronomy. And really, all the work was in reducing the data. So it kind of lost some of the romance to me. Although I did like being in the high desert. I remember it was just an incredibly peaceful place with all these jackrabbits and scrub and everything, and it was very close to the White Mountains, where you get the bristlecone pines, which are the oldest living organisms on Earth. You know, they're trees that have survived above, you know, high up on the mountains for like 5,000 or 6,000 years. You know, they've seen all of recorded history just flash past them. So that was fascinating. So living in California and being able to go to such beautiful places and work with all these telescopes was great, but somehow it kind of lost the romance to me.
What fascinates you the most of the universe? What is it out there that just keeps pushing you?
It really is that there is so much that we don't know. I mean, that's clearly what excites me. I feel that if children are going to school and they're getting the impression that it's all sewn up and we have all the answers, you know, they're getting the wrong picture. There's so much that we don't know. You know, we were talking just before the break about the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic that we have this picture. You know, we know what the universe has been doing over the past 13.82 billion years, and our theories predict pretty much what we see around us today. So we're quite happy about that. But that just allows us to ask even deeper questions. You know, so as we were saying before, what was the Big Bang?
Mm-hmm.
What drove the Big Bang? You know, these are bigger questions. What is space? What is time? So because we've answered a lot of the simple questions, we can now move on to try and address the really big questions. Now, previous generations, they could have addressed those questions, but they didn't know all the details. So we can really look at this. So over the next decade or a couple of decades, space telescopes and things may help us answer some of these really big questions about, you know, what is space, what is time, you know, where did the universe come from? Why is there something rather than nothing? We have a chance of answering these really big questions. So that's what excites me.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Ed's with us. You going to have the Republican convention, Eddie? What do you think?
I think he ought to move it right away, because I think our governor is big trouble for him.
Oh, boy. Okay. Go ahead, Eddie.
Even though we missed the money. I love Marcus. I've got a couple of quick observations. One, to tie it into your area, George, if I was talented enough to have a singing group, rock group, already had my name. It was Neutrino, Catabatic, and Oddlife. Marcus, I like Marcus. Think back just a few hundreds of years. You couldn't go anywhere except on a horse. I mean, we knew nothing. It's amazing out of all the years we've been on Earth and what we now know. And one thing, Marcus, he had a professor on the other night who is actually challenging the Big Bang, saying when you introduce electrical, a pinprick of electricity, it can change that red shift or something. So that's interesting. And Marcus just flies by on one sentence. I love what he said a minute ago. He said, we and by the way, neutrinos come from supernovas. We used to think, we only knew about them in the last 60 years. They think that they're faster than the speed of light for a while because they come before the supernova. And then they finally realized that, well, it's emitted just before the light from a collapsing star supernova, which we wouldn't be here without. We're made of star stuff. That's what creates all the elements. And he says we will look into a telescope with our brain, which is nothing but jelly and water. And that's right. You stick your hand in a brain, it's like jelly and water. I think maybe our mental capacity is really outside of our skull, and the brain in some way is like a calculator, and we use it. So there's so much to learn. And one last thing, mitochondria that's in us, gives us our energy. Most people don't know. I'm wondering if aliens put them in us or something, because they're not part of us. They have their own DNA. I mean, you've got like 10 times more particles and bacteria around your body than trillions of cells you have. You have 10 times more. So I'll kind of leave it there. But I love listening to Marcus.
What do you think of alien intervention there, Marcus? Thanks, Ed.
I think probably we should look for the natural explanation.
Okay.
But I mean, it's Eddie, isn't it? He made some really interesting points, because we talked about neutrinos before, and you may have thought to yourself, who cares? There's these things flooding through us, we can hardly even detect them. What's the point? But what Eddie points out is that we would not be having this conversation without neutrinos, because the elements that are in our bodies, the carbon, the calcium, the magnesium, all this kind of stuff, the oxygen, all of these were forged inside stars. They were forged by nuclear reactions inside massive stars. And those elements would have stayed in those stars, locked away forever, if those stars did not explode. And we think that it's the neutrinos that blow the stars apart. So Eddie mentioned a supernova. A supernova is when a massive star explodes. It's so powerful that it can outshine a galaxy of 100 billion stars. And yet only 1% of its energy is in light. 99% of its energy is in neutrinos. It's the neutrinos that blow the star apart. So these impossibly ridiculous subatomic particles that, you think they've got nothing to do with your everyday life, they're the reason, you've got the iron in your blood, the calcium in your bones, you're breathing in oxygen, the reason that you're actually here. Another thing that Eddie mentioned was interesting is the fact that most of the cells in your body are not yours, which I think is quite interesting. I would put it this way. I would say you're born 100% human, but you die 50% alien. And the reason for that is that half of the cells, 50% of your cells in your body, do not belong to you. They are microorganisms hitching a ride. So there's about 10 million bacteria on every square centimeter of your skin. And the gut bacteria in your stomach, literally, you would not be able to digest your food without them. So if you take an antibiotic and you accidentally kill off all the bacteria in your stomach, you end up with stomach trouble, with diarrhea, because you can't digest your food. So all of these bacteria, all these organisms, were not present when you were born. You get them in your mother's milk. They come from the environment. But by the time you're 3 years old, they're all in place. So again, isn't that incredible that half the cells in your body don't actually belong to it? And it's actually even worse, because it turns out that 99.75% of the DNA in your body does not belong to you. Okay, all but 1/400th of the DNA is in all these other organisms. In a way, you're born 100% human, but you die 99.75%.
Well, that's another thing, too, because with the mysteries of all this, Marcus, the Big Bang and everything, then you have the mystery of life after death and what that's all about. It's probably all connected somehow. We just haven't been able to connect those dots yet.
Well, Eddie mentioned that we're made of stardust. Isn't that the most amazing discovery?
It's true.
Isn't that an incredible thing?
We're 13 billion years old, all of us.
Yeah, literally, the iron in your blood, the oxygen in your lungs, the calcium in your bones, all of these were forged in stars that lived and died before the Earth and the Sun were born. You literally are stardust made flesh. You were literally born in heaven. I mean, isn't that the most... Because we look out at the universe, we think, it has nothing to do with us. Black holes, Big Bang, I mean, this is all ridiculous. It's nothing to do with my everyday life. But in fact, you're connected directly to it, the remote and far away is connected to the mundane and nearby, because the atoms in your body were forged in all these events way across space.
Let's go to Robert in San Diego. Hi, Robert. Go ahead, sir.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Hey, 100 years ago, Abbott wrote a book called Flatland about the three dimensions and two dimensions. And he talked about a little bit about the Euclidean fifth dimension, right, which is basically made of six three-dimensional planes. So six, right? Now, whenever Vera Rubin, or what her name is, says, hey, the galaxies are going too fast, that there's six times as much matter there as we can see, in my mind it says, bingo, that object's a fifth-dimensional object. How come nobody's going down this road? I wish I knew.
All right. Marcus, can you help him?
Well, when you talk about dark matter, there are literally hundreds of possible explanations. The most amazing one came from a guy in New York at Clarkson University, and he actually suggested that dark matter was reverse time matter from the future. Now, isn't that incredible? That was in a paper in Physical Review in about the year 2000. But yeah, we've got no idea what dark matter is. I mean, I can tell you why do you think that people think that it's made of some undiscovered subatomic particle? Because there are a lot of particle physicists in the world.
Sure.
That's why. It could be like black holes the size of your fridge. But there are less astrophysicists in the world than there are particle physicists. So the particle physicists publish more papers about it being a particle. But we've literally got no handle whatsoever on what the dark matter is. So yeah, it could be something to do with extra dimensions. Talking about extra dimensions, one of the biggest mysteries is why gravity is so weak. Now, you might think that gravity is strong. I mean, you know, try leaping a meter in the air, you know, you get pulled back down again. But the electric force operating in your body, holding your atoms together, it isn't just 10 times stronger than gravity or 100 times stronger. It's 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity. You don't notice it because there's an equal amount of positive and negative charge, and so the attractive and the repulsive forces perfectly cancel out. But So the electric force is 1 followed by 40 zeros stronger than gravity. So no one can understand that. But one possible explanation, you may have heard of string theory.
Yes.
And this is this idea that the basic building blocks of matter are not like little tiny billiard balls. They are tiny little vibrating strings of mass energy. This theory only works in 10 dimensions of space-time. And so we obviously don't live in 10 dimensions. You know, I mean, I can only see four. So there's, you know, north, south, east, west, up, down, past, future. There's only four. So the physicists say, well, there's six that are actually very small, that you can't see them. Well, it could be that gravity operates in all 10 dimensions, and therefore it leaks out into the extra six dimensions. So it's the only force that leaks out into the extra six, and therefore that's why it's much weaker, because we only see the bit that hasn't leaked out. So that's actually one possible explanation, but really most of us is completely baffled that the electric force is 1 followed by 40 zeros stronger than the gravitational force.
Let's go to Mayat in New York City. Hi, Mayat.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
Excellent, fascinating program. And George, happy upcoming Tuesday, Earth Day, if I don't talk to you, and many, many more. First, a brief comment, and then a three-part question, and I'll listen over the air.
Okay.
First of all, Marcus, thank you for resisting the anti-intellectualism that will be the demise of any decent and virtuous civilization. We need to remember that wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross is how Sinclair Lewis characterized how fascism would come to America. So that's where we are. But my question deals with how does Heidegger give us a cat that's both dead and alive, your thoughts on that physicist and his theory, and also on David Bohm, who had some very interesting conversations with the mystic Krishnamurti. your thoughts on his work. And lastly, PBS had a documentary some years ago about, she had an unusual first name, Einstein's first wife, started with an M, like Marina, or, but at any rate, she signed the theory, which was at relativity theory in 1905. She actually was a co-author on that. And if you have my questions, and I like your thoughts on whether you're aware of that, I'll listen over the air. Thank you so much.
Take a few of those if you can, Marcus.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, I mean, you talk about Schrodinger. Owen Schrodinger, who was an Austrian physicist, and we're talking about Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've discovered since I mentioned earlier in this interview, I talked about James Clerk Maxwell. He was the first person to realize that the actual fundamental world, the physical world, is not like the everyday world. So he described what we call magnetic and electric fields. You can't really imagine them. They fill all of space. They're not like anything. You can't compare them to a football. You can't, you know, they're not like that. Before that, we talked about that we had a mechanical universe of Newton, and we can always compare atoms to little footballs and whatever. But so we've realized that the fundamental world is not the way that it appears to us. You know, that's an incredible discovery. So now we talk about, for instance, string theory, where we have dimensions that we can't actually see. But one of the fundamental things about atoms and their constituents that we discovered in the late 1920s is that they can be in several places at once. They can do several things at once. Okay, so you know, it's like you doing your weekend shopping at the supermarket and playing football at the same time. Now that is completely, there's no comparison that you can make.
It's illogical, isn't it?
Illogical. But this is the way the real world really is. Okay, it is actually possible to get an atom to be in two places at once, the equivalent of you being in New York and San Francisco at the same time. So at some level, we just have to take what nature is telling us. What it's basically telling us is that the building blocks of matter are not like anything in our everyday experience. Remember, our everyday experience has come from, as I said, arising on an African plain 3 million years ago. You know, we see things which are good for our survival. You know, there's a saber-toothed tiger over there. We've got to watch it. You know, that's why our hearing has the range it has, our eyesight has the range it has. But the incredible thing is that the physicists have gone beyond that to see that these properties of the universe that we needed to see for our survival are not really the only properties. And there are many properties which are not accessible to our senses. So I can't really tell you why an atom can be in two places at once, but observations in millions of experiments show that that is actually possible, which is incredible. You mentioned Bohm. He came up with what we call an interpretation of quantum theory called the pilot wave theory, which I think has probably been ruled out, but he did have a lot of mystical discussion. So there's actually a tendency to think, well, quantum theory, which is our theory of the microscopic world of atoms and their constituents, is mysterious in many ways.
Marcus, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and wrap things up and take final calls next. We'll be back in a moment with Marcus Towne and take final phone calls as we talk about his work, The Magicians, Great Minds, and the Central Miracle of Science. So get ready for that. On our next Coast to Coast program, our investigative reporter Cheryl Jones joins us with some stories of high strangeness, followed by conversations with Cheryl. So make sure you're part of that program. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Marcus Chown with us. His book, The Magicians. Where do you get the book, Marcus?
Well, I'm so pleased you asked me that, because it's available. You can get it on Kindle, on Amazon Kindle, but I don't actually have an American publisher. I'm published in lots of countries around the world.
Aha.
I'm not published in America. So thanks for asking me that. If there's a publisher in America that would like to publish it, that would be fantastic.
Well, there may be. Have you ever... The Ascent of Gravity, was that published here too?
Yes, it was. Yeah, The Ascent of Gravity was, and that was a quite a successful book. But not this one, no. So I'm very pleased to be on your program and to have this platform. Thank you.
Okay, well, maybe there's a publisher out there who hears this and jumps all over this, because it's a fascinating story. What do you think, Marcus, the big breakthrough will be for all of us to get that information about black holes, dark matter, the, you know, the Big Bang. Is there going to be a moment that something happens and we've got some answers?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're at a very, very interesting point in the history of science. We're at a point where lots of things do not fit together, where there are lots and lots of paradoxes. That's a very important time. The last time it happened was the 1920s. Basically, the theory we had of physics told us that atoms could not exist. It was as blatant as that. And, of course, they do exist. So that was such an amazing contradiction. And it was resolved by quantum theory, which is our theory of atoms and their constituents. And quantum theory has given us lasers, computers, nuclear reactors. It tells us why the ground is solid, why the sun shines. It's responsible for, I think, 30% of the GDP of America. And now we're at a stage where lots of things don't fit. You know, 95% of the universe is invisible. We don't know what it is. So we're at a very exciting time where there's some big idea missing. Just like quantum theory came in the 1920s, some big idea is missing. The main problem we actually have in fundamental physics is that there are two towering achievements of 20th century physics. One is quantum theory. The theories are very small. The other is Einstein's theory of gravity, which is a theory of very big things. Now, you might think, well, why do you have to mesh those two theories? One's a theory of the small, one's a theory of the big. Well, of course, once you know that the universe formed in a Big Bang, you know that the universe was once very small. So the very big universe was once very small. Okay, so those two theories must overlap in order to explain, we were talking about this before, in order to understand the Big Bang, in order to understand where it all came from, we have to unite these two theories. But the problem is that quantum theory is a theory of chance and probability, okay? And Einstein's theory of gravity is not. So they seem to be fundamentally incompatible. But that's the big leap. And you know, we began this program talking about how Newton had changed the face of physics during
the
lockdown.
That's right.
In 1665, 1666. Maybe somebody in the lockdown somewhere around the world has the key idea that's going to change physics.
To the phones now we go. Let's go to David in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, well, it won't be me, but it may have been a cousin of mine, a hobby of mine, Ernest Orlando Lawrence, Nobel Prize winner for inventing the cyclotron and the
How about
first
that?
To split the atom. I'd like to tap into your expertise. In your assessment, what contributions, what's the significance of Ernest Orlando Lawrence in all of this?
Well, again, there was a time back in the early part of the 20th century when the key experimental physicist in the world was Ernest Rutherford. And he basically, was the person who discovered the atomic nucleus, who changed one nucleus into another. And all of his experiments were done on a tabletop, basically with, you know, sellotape and glue. But then Lorentz, as you say, with particle accelerators, you know, that people realize that to probe this small-scale world, you need big, big experiments. And they culminated in the Large Hadron Collider, which spans two countries, Switzerland, at the border of Switzerland and France, where we've discovered things like the Higgs particle. So really, the role of recognizing that big particle accelerators are what you need is that was the achievement.
Next up, we go to McKinley in Rockland, California. Hi, McKinley. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, George.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that many of the thoughts that those very profound insights that your guest Marcus is presenting also makes apparent that much that is constantly, every day, influencing our lives is invisible, such as gravity,
mm-hmm.
and mind, consciousness, thoughts, and even viruses, which we don't see with our naked eye. And regarding the Big Bang, that would not even be comprehensible if there had not been existing prior to that a hypothetical or postulated occurrence in space, constraining and absorptive properties to prevent that bang from continuing on and on and on and not stopping.
Good point. Marcus, what do you think of that?
we don't actually know why it did not continue. I told you about this process called inflation, which apparently was basically, if you imagine the Big Bang as the explosion of a stick of dynamite, inflation, which came before, was like a nuclear explosion. And inflation had to come to an end. And we don't know at the moment why it came to an end, and as you say, why it didn't continue. But your first point is really interesting because, you know, this is our achievement as a human race, you know, that we've discovered so much about the universe that's invisible. You know, as I say, we have senses which developed on an African plain, you know, and yet we've got artificial senses, technological senses, which have allowed us to probe the universe at very small scales, you know, on very big scales with big telescopes, and to discover that much of what the universe is doing is invisible to our senses. I mean, that is an unbelievable achievement. I mean, you know, we're constantly often bashing ourselves and saying, oh, my God, the human race has done all these terrible things to the environment. It's, you know, we've done this, we've done that. But now and then I think we ought to just sit down and think, my God, look what we've achieved. It's absolutely incredible what we've achieved.
Marcus, you're a scientist. Most scientists aren't spiritual or religious. How about you?
I'm not, no, but some are. And as I mentioned, Isaac Newton was, and many scientists are. You know, I think it doesn't add anything to me. I look at the universe and I think, what an incredible universe that I live in. I can't quite believe it. It's more amazing than anything that we could possibly have imagined. You know, a place where a single atom can be in two places at once, you know. There's all kinds of things I could tell you which just blow your mind. An electron, take an electron. If you stand on the spot and you turn around through 360 degrees, you do a complete rotation, you're the same person. But an electron isn't. It has to turn twice through two complete turns to be the same electron. How mad is that? You know, we're living in this, it is an Alice in Wonderland world, you know, which is stranger than science fiction. So I look at the universe and I just think, wow, isn't it amazing? And people who are religious look at the universe and they think, wow, it's amazing. God created it. So they just add that one thing. But I still think it's amazing.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Kyle is with us in Georgia. First time caller. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for holding so long.
I what Marcus was just saying, that I've had a real fascination with the universe as well. And, you know, when I look out in space and you see these galaxies off in these distances, and not just that they're moving away from us, but that space itself is actually expanding and, you know, between us. And dark energy is causing that. And, you know, dark energy is about 70% of the universe. And I just wonder, I think, you know, that seems like a huge portion of the universe that we really don't know anything about. And, you know, what kind of potential, you know, maybe like an energy source or something, could that maybe be for humanity?
And how do we find out about it, Marcus? How do we really get the answers to dark matter?
First of all, we can see its effect in the universe, and that's obvious. So we can characterize its behavior, but somehow we have to detect it on Earth, you know. And we've been looking at, for instance, the Large Hadron Collider. Is there any missing energy? You know, I mean, is there suddenly energy vanishing from our experiment, and we don't know how it's vanished, you know, taken away by a dark matter particle? So experiments have been looking for about 20, 30 years now to find dark matter on Earth, but they haven't actually found it. As for dark energy, the problem is that it's fantastically dilute. So, you know, it exists in the room where you are now or wherever you are now, but it's far too dilute. But when you add up lots and lots of it over cosmic dimensions, it becomes important. So only on the very, it's not important in the solar system, it's not important in our real galaxy, but on a large scale, it's speeding up the expansion of the universe. So all we can actually do is continue to observe the galaxies flying away and try and pin down more and more about the characteristics of dark energy. We believe that it only switched on about 10 billion years ago. So the universe is about 14 billion years, 13.82 billion years ago, but we believe it switched on about 10 billion years ago. So, again, we need to learn something about, well, how did it switch on? You know, where did it come from? So we are grasping, this is a really difficult problem, the dark energy problem. But you know, there's an interesting, you know, when you talk about could we use any of this one day, who knows? Nobody ever guessed that we would use nuclear power. I mean, there was a time when nobody knew about electricity. You know, this incredible power that powers the entire world now. It powers the entire world, by the way, because the electric force, as I told you, is 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity. That's the basis of how we can power the whole world. So invisible things have turned out to be very useful in the past. They might in the future. Actually, I'm just feeling a bit guilty about that woman who I didn't answer in New York. She wanted to know whether Mileva Maric, Einstein's first wife, had contributed to relativity.
Did she?
The answer to that is that she probably didn't, but she was probably a good critic of it, and Einstein himself had started thinking about relativity when he was 16, so I don't think that's correct. There are many women who've been 16. Overlooked in physics, but I don't think Mileva Maric was one of them.
Speaking of New York, we're going back there with Janet. Hi, Janet. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'd like to ask about the evolution of the elements. At the time of the Big Bang, as far as we know, was there already, I mean, did there immediately appear hydrogen and only hydrogen? And then what happens? Two hydrogen atoms smash together and we have helium, and gradually we get the heavier and heavier elements. And the question specifically about iron, I hate to ask you to explain what someone else said, but I did hear a scientist say something very intriguing, and I had no idea what he meant. Maybe you do. It was on Seth Shostak's program, by the way, Big Picture Science, which is a great show. Yeah. And he said, talking about these elements becoming heavier and heavier, he said every element wants to become iron. And I don't know what that means. What is special? Is there something special about iron? Is it some endpoint that is wished for? And when that happens, something happens in the universe? I mean, it's far from the heaviest element. What is there something special about the presence of iron in the universe?
I quickly answer that one. It's strongly bound. It's very strongly bound, so it's very stable. But also, it's the end point. In stars, basically, you start off with hydrogen, the lightest element. Imagine it's a Lego brick, and then they slam together to make, as you point out, helium, and then carbon and oxygen, all the heavy elements. And all of those nuclear reactions give out heat, so they allow stars to shine. But when you get to iron and you get beyond iron, the nuclear reactions then suck in energy. And so the star can no longer support itself. It can no longer generate the heat to support itself. So that's why iron is an endpoint in normal stars. And all the heavier elements are only produced, for instance, in supernovae, so when the star blows up. Now, you're talking about what did the universe begin as. We're not completely certain, but we think it probably did start with hydrogen and, well, protons and neutrons. These are the two components of atomic nuclei. And this is in the Big Bang. And neutrons actually decay. They actually disintegrate and become protons within about 10, 15 minutes, something like that. So if you run the expansion of the universe, so it's blisteringly hot, it's got protons and neutrons, you run that, you find that the neutrons will all decay into protons within about 14 minutes. And that just gives you just enough time for a few of those neutrons to stick to protons and make helium. And when you do that calculation, you find out that something like 1 in 10 nuclei these are the cores of atoms, 1 in 10 ends up as helium. So the universe is 90% hydrogen, 10% helium.
Marcus, great job for us. His book, The Magicians. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.